Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away this week. I'm Brian Ellison. When we talk about religion, we sometimes use the word spiritual. Spiritual meaning those things that may be true but that we can't see or hear or touch. And we sometimes contrast spiritual with physical objects in the world around us. But the fact is that almost all the religions of the world devote substantial attention to the physical, to objects that can be experienced by the senses. In fact, the same objects turn up again and again throughout history and across traditions, meaning different things, but sometimes with surprising similarities. Today, our religion roundtable is back on Up to Date as we explore stones and bread and other objects and what their use across traditions may show us about how people connect with what can't be touched and seen. Joining us today at the roundtable are Manaz Shabir. She's a leading voice in the local Muslim community and in interfaith activities. Manaz, good to see you again.
Hello there. How are you?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Moses Brings Plenty is community outreach liaison and culture and arts facilitator for the Heart of America Indian Center here in Kansas City. Welcome to you, Moses.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Glad you're here. And joining us by phone from Portland, Oregon is Yangsi Rinpoche. He's president of Maitripa College in Portland, and which is an institution that offers graduate degrees in Buddhist studies. Rinpoche, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
We're glad you're here. I want to begin by acknowledging that today's program is inspired, at least in part, by a new book that's out this month called A History of Religion in 5½ Objects by S. Brent Plate. It makes a really interesting case about how the material and the spiritual interact in various religions, and we'll talk about some of the particular objects of which that is true in a moment. First, let me ask each of our guests to talk a little bit about their own traditions and about the relationship in them between the spiritual and the physical. Is one more important than the other? Manaz?
One more important than the other. I think the what comes in from the heart is probably the most important, but what we do as a Muslim, we do have things that help us in our observance as being a Muslim. For example, like a prayer rug, or when we go for Hajj, there's certain things that we wear for men. And so these are the things that are part of our tradition. And so it's like when you see these things, you know that this is part of our faith.
And you're a practitioner of traditional religious practices from your Lakota nation, Moses. How do the spiritual and physical intersect in your tradition?
It is very much connected, you know, and what's important for us is self, who we, our lifestyle, how we live, and the things that we do, because what we do, we represent the spiritual realm and most of all the creator of all creation.
And Rinpoche, I think folks may be unfamiliar with a lot of Buddhist practices. How does the spiritual intersect with the physical in your tradition?
Yes. In the Buddhism, like particularly in the Tibetan Buddhism, like symbols and objects, they become like a condition to enhancing inner spiritual experience. And basically, those external objects are just a condition and to reminder for the practitioners to specific, such as a wisdom, such as a concentration, such as a compassion. So objects are, external objects are like a, just as a minor condition. It doesn't play really important, I mean, like in for some individuals at the beginning practitioners, maybe it may play a kind of important role, but as a Buddhism, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, it just plays as a condition.
When you say it plays as a condition, are you saying that it is sort of an instrument to something else, something deeper?
Absolutely. Those external condition becomes conditioned to deepen our inner spiritual experience. And as I mentioned, as a compassion, as a wisdom, as a concentration. So it is just kind of like a supporting condition to deepening individual spiritual experience.
Am I right to make that contrast between spiritual and physical? You know, we often do that. We contrast what can be seen and touched and felt with something that is deeper. Is that really a good way to think about your religious practice? I mean, Manaz, in Islam?
Like for Islam, you know, when we think of our faith and our practicing, we don't have, like when we think of Allah, which is the Arabic word for God, it doesn't have a form. It has no context as far as a physical that we can kind of imagine. It's just present. And so we do make a really distinction of not trying to put any type of form on that concept. But we do have things that help us, that guide us in our practice. So I think, you know, there's that distinction, and we just have to be really careful not to collapse them on top of each other.
Yeah, does that ring true in yours, or is there a distinction to be made in Native American traditions?
Well, there's a big distinction for us. You know, we look at it as the original creation is the original children, and they're the symbolism of God. Because let's take language, for example. No human being is born with language, but yet a baby deer, a baby bear, or even a horse, every animal and plant is born knowing and speaking their own language. Mm. So they have such an intelligence that the creator, Wakantaka, how we say, the great spirit in our language, instilled within them a knowledge and an intelligence and a wisdom. You know, we're us as common people, as human beings, we are the most pitiful of all creation. So we turn to them to find God. We see God within them. And that's why when we pray, we acknowledge all of our relatives who had given us a language, who had given us an instruction or a way to live and how to be. You know, and so it is very, very, God is all around us.
I guess I wonder, Rinpoche, if you think that there would be any way to achieve a true or a real spiritual understanding without the presence or the use of those physical things, those objects?
It depends. Like, for example, as I mentioned earlier, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, the external object and the individuals are interdependent. And their spiritual experience and growth of spiritual experience are also interdependent. So therefore, in a beginner practitioners, at the beginning when you're training, symbols become supporting condition, very part of the spiritual practice. But when you advance your spiritual practice, then you go beyond the external object. You are not depending for the external object. You're basically, mostly you depend into your own inner experience, an inner object, we can say, you know, inner object, which are the realization and the experience. So like, for example, in the Tibetan Buddhism, you know, practitioners, they go in a hermit, in the mountains, in the caves, without so many religious objects. They just go with their mind and body only, and, you know, stay in very high mountains without any kind of those materials. Mm-hmm. So it just depends. You know, the beginner practitioners, yes, they depend for a certain extent for the external object. And when in long term, you go beyond the external object.
You know, I'm struck by the way that there's probably even a range of thought within various traditions about the connection between physical and spiritual. I think of divisions in the early Christian church with some parts of the church regarding the physical or the body as evil, as tainted and sinful, and other parts saying, no, this was created by God, or people created in the image of God, thus to be seen as holy. And that was a source of early division in the Christian community. Do you see there's a range of ways that your traditions understand these matters?
Well, in Islam, you know, it's just like in Christianity, there's different schools of thought. And so, for example, in the Shia faith, they actually do use more symbolism as far as praying on top of something that came from the sands of Karbala. But so it can vary from one area of Islam to another. But in general, though, it's very common that, you know, we pray on the prayer rug, we're facing towards the Kaaba. Again, the Kaaba is a symbolism for our direction, no matter where we are in the world. As Muslims, we pray towards that direction. And on the Kaaba, there is a stone that we call the black stone, and it's and we walk around the Kaaba. So we all do that as a common, but how we observe these things may be a little different from one school to another.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske today. This is the Religion Roundtable. We're talking today about objects and faith in various traditions. My guests are Manaz Shabir of the Muslim faith, Moses Brings Plenty of his Lakota traditional religion, and Yangtze Rinpoche, who is a professor and president of a Buddhist graduate institution. They're all talking about the role of objects and the physical in the spiritual practices of faith. The book I mentioned earlier, A History of Religion in Five and a Half Objects by Brent Plate, that title, the half object that he's talking about is the body, the human body, which he says all religions see as somehow incomplete in and of itself. It's reaching out for something else. And his point in that title, as he explains in the book, is that all those other objects, the ones that connect with sight and sound, obtain significance only because the body connects with them. The body needs that to give them meaning, give them completion. He says the human body is the key object that holds all the others together, the object that smells the incense or tastes the bread or hears the drums. Do you think that's a fair description of how your tradition sees the body? Is it incomplete in and of itself? I'll invite any of our guests to speak up.
I'd like to touch base on that. It's for us as Lakota or Indian people, period, you know, today, society, people try to tell us there's a separation between spirit and the physical. And they even go as far as when they speak about the spiritual realm, there's a whole different world versus this world. When in fact, if you look at ourselves, our spirit is within us. And we are also in the physical sense here to experience this world, this realm. And so, as young people, we go on a hill for one of our particular ceremonies. We go up with nothing. Mm-hmm. We go up with nothing but ourselves. And we fast. We go without food and water to take our physical being to the extreme of coming, reconnecting to the spiritual being. Because if we lived our lives on a daily basis and thought as everything of God being created equal, then we are now walking in as a spiritual being, not so much as a physical. You know, like for me, I could never leave this continent because this is where our ceremonial, my physical is connected to this land, you know, and so I can't go somewhere else to another country and perform the same ceremonies that we are able to do here. And that's just one of the protocols of God. And that has been given to our people.
I mean, Moses, do Indian religions perceive a spirit that is in some way separate from the body? Can it be separated that way?
No. We have, religion calls them angels. We have spirits that come, and these spirits have names, and we're able to see them with our physical eyes. We're able to, you know, cast our eyes upon them and know that they're there, and not just ourselves, but other individuals that are sitting in that ceremony.
Rinpoche, body and spirit, can they even be separated?
Yes, from the Buddhist point of view, you know, we will say like consciousness, and the body is like, you know, just kind of like, if I put like a body is like a guest house, and the consciousness is the guest. So guests will travel, or the traveler will travel in the different guest house, you know, in different places, you know, so therefore body is as a, like, from the Buddhist perspective, just as a, like a guest house, we have this, you know, came from past life to this life, from this life to will travel to the next life. So from point of view, body is as a, just as a, like a kind of like the house and the consciousness or spirit or consciousness. That is the what is the taking the journey. So therefore, from that point of view, like our body is, you know, from the as an object, you know, his in the book mentioned half the five and half. You know, that's the body, you know, external object, and then the body and the consciousness. You know, when we say spiritual practice in a religious, deepening religious experience, it's not by deepening by our body, but deepening by our consciousness, our awareness and consciousness. So therefore, from one perspective, body is becoming also as an object. It's not as an object, the external object, as a, like a you know, bells and incense and so on and so forth. So the practitioners, their consciousness utilizing your body and the external objects such as, you know, bells and incense and so on and so forth.
Do you think that taking that position is a devaluing in any sense of the body?
Not at all. Body becomes, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, the body becomes a really important, instrument to spiritual, furthermore deepening spiritual experience. When you say body, body means is the collections of the four elements. And in advanced practitioners, our four elements are becoming one of the crucial conditions to deepening our spiritual experience. So therefore, it is a really valued so much. And therefore, there is such an emphasis in the spiritual practitioners have to really pay attention which kind of diet you are taking, how you take care of your body, awareness of your health.
Manas Shabir, what portion of our identity do you, from the perspective of Islam, think is in our body?
This is a really challenging question.
Good.
Yeah, because, you know, I've been listening to the other two guests and trying to think of how I could relate this to as a Muslim, because, you know, we believe in the concept of the one God, and we have practices that we do as praying, fasting, going for Hajj. And this is our body that's doing these things, giving charity. And our goal as a practicing Muslim is to do the best we can and to improve ourselves each and every time. And so there isn't a place to get to except at the end of our life. I mean, and we hope that whatever we've done during our lifetime will help us get into paradise, into heaven, because we believe that we will be rewarded for those things that we've done, good deeds, and we will be punished for things that we haven't. So our goal is to do as many good things in our lifetime as possible as our body. And we teach these things to our children as well.
But is it when the heaven, the paradise, is this a place where the body then experiences sights and sounds and touch, or is it an entirely spiritual realm?
It is a spiritual realm, and there's a place where we believe in the last day of judgment, and we will come back, you know, our souls will come back, and we will be judged. But it's not like it's black and white, you know, and it's, of course, it's just by the teachings.
This is an interesting conversation we're having today about objects and the physical in relation to faith and the spiritual. I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. What objects are important to you in your own religious or spiritual practice? What significance do sights and sounds and scents and touch have for your religious practice? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. We'd love to hear from you with your suggestions, your ideas, and your views on objects and faith. 816-235-2888. I want to talk about some of the specific objects which the book that I mentioned by Brent Plate sort of lifts up as having relevance in multiple traditions. And one of them that he mentions is incense, which is really interesting to think about the role that this plays in so many completely different, completely historically separate traditions. Maybe we don't think of objects and sensory experiences as the common ground between religions, but it seems like this is something they do have in common. Maybe each of you could talk a little bit about the function of incense in your tradition. Let me go to you, Rinpoche.
Yes. Now, incense is we use lots of in our ritual ceremony, gatherings and spiritual gatherings and so on and so forth. Even though also in the individual's personal practice, you know, morning when you get to do your meditation, right before that you put the incense on. So incense really plays from this point of view, it is kind of to smoothing the environment and purifying the environment, something way to creating very peaceful and calm environment. So it is working towards the internal environment and external environment. So the incense kind of like a you know, orientating for individual practitioners to kind of going to their own meditation practice. So, you know, particularly between the, particularly in the Tibetan Buddhism, where they implement the incense into their ritual ceremonies, and also in Catholicism, it looks like very similarities. There's like any ceremony happens, they bring the incense. Like, for example, anytime the masters comes to the giving a talk, the first person will bring the incense, and the masters follow through after the incense. And like, for example, group meditations will, you know, again, we put on the incense to basically to smoothing the environment, to making conducive environment. So that's kind of playing the important role by the incense in Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism particularly.
Kind of setting a mood, to be a little more simplistic about it. It creates an atmosphere that people feel is sacred and worshipful.
Exactly.
Manaz, is that the same use that incense plays in Islam?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And there isn't like in Islam, this is, you know, incense. It's not like that. I think a lot of it has to do with cultures. Mm. And so, like in the Asian cultures, they do use incense. But it's kind of like setting the tone, like when you smell it, you know, that something's about to happen, you know, that kind of thing. But I know, like, even in Mecca, they use something called oud, which is like another type of incense that burns. So people look for these things. And I think it's more of like a symbolism versus an actual practice.
Moses brings plenty. Native American traditions use a great deal of incense and engage the sense of smell.
Well, I totally agree with what she just said, that for us it's just a symbolism. It's not we use cedar. Cedar is one of the biggest things that we use, and what it symbolizes is that life is forever. And so when we smell it, there is something that's going to be happening. We're getting ready to step into a different place or a different position.
Do you feel like it's something that's added for the sake of the human participants, or is it something that that the divine ones, that God or gods desire? Is it really for us, or is it for the divine?
I think it's more so for us, because you think about it, the human race is probably the only creation that does have a scent that they give off, and it's not really the most beautiful scent, you know, but everything else, you know, the flowers, there's so many different plants, so many different animals that have a scent that they give off, and it's a beautiful scent. You know, so we need a substance or something to help us to let the Creator know, you know, how we feel, actually, you know, how we perceive God, because we don't have many gods. There's only one Creator of all creation. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about us as American Indian people. You know, that there's only one Creator of all creation. We just honor those who had shared with us, the original children, the original creation.
Excellent point. And I guess I'm what's coming to my mind is out of the Psalms, out of Jewish or Christian tradition, may my prayers rise to you as incense, that there's this connection, the smoke going up, it connects not only with smell but with sight, this idea that somehow something is transacting between human beings and the divine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I comment one thing with it?
Please.
Yeah. Like, particularly the smell also kind of strongly connected with our memory. You know, it brings kind of, I think also the incense, the smell, it kind of, you know, which can go inside our body, you know, like a stone and bells, those objects is just there. You can just, you know, you can hear the sound of that. But the smell, that external object that can really, you know, travel really deep into our human body. And also it plays some kind of like an important, you know, to recall. You know, so therefore, I think there's a specific ritual ceremony where we really put so many incense, and during that time, all the practitioners have to stay a very deep concentration practice. And the smell of incense and the concentration practice have an integration. So I think this is something, you know, external condition playing important role to inner experience.
It made me think when you said that, Rinpoche, of sort of maybe the smell of your grandmother's house or something. As soon as you smell it, it brings back this flood of other memories and of associations and feelings.
That.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have an object or a sensory experience that connects with your own religious faith or practice. Janet is on the line from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Janet.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to, I started off my call, I wanted to say that a long time ago when I was doing a lot of reading and studying of interfaith practices, religious leader once said to me, "Well, Janet, you know, we are in skin. We are skinners. And as long as we're in skin, it helps to have something physical to connect with the spiritual, whatever that is." And that, I'm from the Catholic tradition, so there was, oh my gosh, so many, you know, the rosary, there was the incense, there was the bell ringing, there was so many sensory experiences. And when that man said that to me, I thought, that rings so true.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm curious, Janet, from your Catholic background and experience, would the faith, would the religious truth of it all seem less real or less important if you didn't have those sensory experiences?
Well, I don't practice Catholicism at this time in my life, and so I have many ways of reaching a spiritual place inside of myself. But as a person, you know, forming in a faith, a belief in a spiritual, I think those things certainly did help me, just like when we teach children to learn numbers by manipulation of blocks and things, of physical objects. And so I think that might be a part of it. The physical might be a step on the path to something that might be more deeper in me, for which I don't need a physical object.
Janet, thanks so much for your call.
Okay. Bye.
We're going to take a short break. When we continue, we'll continue to explore some of the ways that religions of the world engage the senses and the similarities and important differences in what the use of those objects means for them. We'll talk about bread. We'll talk about drums. We'll even talk about crosses. We also want to hear from you. What physical objects or sights and sounds matter for your own faith? You can email us at uptodate@kcur.org. You can also call us at 816-235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Today we are welcoming our religion roundtable and talking about the place of objects, sensory experiences, things you can see and smell and taste in religious practice. My guests are Manaz Shabir. She is a local Muslim leader and also a management consultant. We've got Moses Bringsplenty here, community outreach liaison and culture and arts facilitator at the Heart of America Indian Center. And also joining us by phone is Yongsi Rinpoche, who's president of Maitripa College in Portland and a Buddhist spiritual director as well. We're also taking your calls at 816-235-2888, as well as your emails. And we had an email from Marcus who said, "I'm interested to hear what your guests have to say about people borrowing, quote, holy objects and symbols from other cultures and how they can be very powerful and personal for us despite having no real connection to the faith or traditions of the originating culture." Don't know exactly what objects Marcus might have been thinking of, but maybe things like, a cross, if you're not a Christian, or a particular religious image out of another tradition when you don't particularly venerate, or a rosary, or beads. Manaz, what do you think of that?
Right. Well, yeah, let's talk about beads.
And Manaz is sitting here in our studio holding a string of beads.
Right. We call this thesbi. And so for Muslims, it's divided into three parts. And so the first part has us saying that God is great, on the other end saying that praise God and thank God. And so some people would say, well, this could be rosaries, but we call it thesbi. and we use these after we do our prayers.
And do you use it the way Catholics use a rosary, where each bead sort of is a reminder to pray in a particular way?
No, it's just where I'm, like, when I'm using it in my hand, I'll say Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. I'm just saying God is great, God is great, you know. And so it's not the same, but it's similar.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that in this conversation, I think, about objects. Another object that that the book lifts up is the object of bread. Bread seems to occupy a place in many different traditions, but it tends to mean some very different things. I think many listeners will be familiar with the bread that is part of Passover feasts, for example, in Jewish tradition, the breaking of the matzah at a particular moment in the ceremony. Many will be familiar with the Eucharist or the communion use of bread in Christian tradition. What place does bread occupy in your traditions? In Native American traditions, there is a role for bread, right?
Nope.
No? Not so much?
No role for bread.
According to Brent Plate in his book, he talks a little bit about the traditions of fry bread and in the, let's see, the Navajo tribe's exodus from Arizona and how it he lifts it up. Yeah, I hear you chuckling. So
yeah, bread is a contemporary food for our people. We didn't have ovens. You know, everything was cooked openly, and most tribes ate dried meat, corn, and again, we didn't have ovens. You know, you was talking about how people borrow symbols from other tribes or other religions. I really want to touch base on that, because that's one of the biggest problems that we have today as Indian people. You know, if you take something that you did not earn, and how you earn thing is understanding the protocol of it, and you try to benefit from it yourself. You know, most people, they talk about this new age movement, and a lot of it has to do with Native American, I'm going to say Native American spirituality, because I don't even know what Native American spirituality is, you know, because I'm an Indian, not a Native American. And so when you look at it, people borrow from our ways of life. Let's take the pipestone, for example. People take that and they go ahead and they sell it, or they utilize it to be a predator and prey on innocent people who are looking for and trying to find a way of life, and even a drum, so on and so forth. And what that does for us is it affects the individuals, the source. We are the source of that. And not only that, but it signs the death warrant of our children. And so you look at our Indian people, we have such a high rise of suicide. It's because a lot of these non-native people are stealing our traditional ways of life and making a mockery of it and just selling it. The creator don't know what money is. The spirits don't know what money is, because the creator never made it. And so if it's truly a gift, if I said, here's a gift, Brian, but I said, can you give me $5? Is it still a gift?
Right.
No, it's not. A gift is something that is free and handed to you. And so it really bugs me when people take from other religious ways and other cultures and try to mold it into whatever they want, they choose, and what fits them at their comfort level. You know, and so it irritates me, if you can't tell that already.
No, and I it sounds like rightly so. Rinpoche, does Buddhism see its own sort of sacred objects picked up or appropriated outside of its traditions?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, when they use those sacred objects into individuals' own desires and kind of like misuse it, I think is a really inappropriate. And of course, in today's world, like, there's a lot of Buddhist symbols being in the markets, and you know, it is treated as not as a spiritual object, is it treated as a like a decoration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of like it loses its own spiritual value. And it, you know, people take as a decoration or some kind of, just to, again, it's using those objects to smoothing their sense. So that kind of like indulgence for the religious object is, I also think, it is really inappropriate. But, you know, that's just my idea. And
sure. No, I think I hear that in our other guests. I hear that sometimes from Christians who see the abundance of people wearing crosses or even tattooing crosses on themselves, but who do not appear to be doing that as a religious expression, per se. Let's take a call from, as we move on to other objects and other sensory experiences that that bring meaning to people's faith. Mike is calling us from Baldwin City. Good morning, Mike.
Thank you. I'm Choctaw from Alabama, Mississippi, and I stomp dance. I smell the wood smoke, the carrying on the spirit. A lot of the southeastern tribes, like the Creek and the Uchi and the Chickasaw and the Cherokee, have. And the formation of the snake as we're dancing around the fire. And I read this is like a big thing for me, and I have to go down to Oklahoma and Mississippi to do it, but I really gain a lot from the smell of the smoke and the symbolism of the snake within a lot of southeastern cultures. That was my comment.
Yeah, and can you talk about what it is you gain, Mike? How does that take you to a more spiritual place in a way that just sort of sitting quietly and thinking or praying wouldn't?
A sense of togetherness with the other Indians with me, a sense of what Christian missionaries tried to take away when they called it pagan, when the missionaries in Mississippi and Oklahoma tried to do away with the stomp dances, and a sense of identity.
Great.
Because it's a lot of tribes like the Yaqui and some people and some of the older Kickapoo ways here in Kansas, they had to synthesize Christianity and their traditional beliefs to be able to survive where the non-Indians would persecute them. But it stomp dancing is like a purely Indian thing.
I appreciate your calling in, Mike. Thank you so much for your call. Another of the objects that's lifted up in Brent Plate's book, in one that I maybe didn't think of especially as a religious object, but which does indeed play a part in many traditions, is drums. Moses, maybe you could talk a little bit about the role of drums in Indian religion.
Yes, like I said, to date there's 566 federally recognized tribes, and a lot of tribes, they allow women to drum and sit at the drum, where a lot of tribes don't. Let's take Lakota people, for example. We have a very small group of women. We consider them our true leaders. We consider them our holy women. They have the right to carry a drum and to drum, you know. But other than outside of that, the women are already the drum. Because when you are born, when you are being carried within your mother for 9 months, you listen to her heartbeat. Huh. So she's already the drum. And so us men, when we play the drum, for us, it is a reminder of our mother. And who is our mother? Our real mother is the earth. You know, if you take a child and you put them in a playpen, you put all the toys within them, and you let them go for a whole day, but you leave them alone, about 15 minutes later, they're going to get upset. But you take that same child and you just hand them a stone and you put them outside in the dirt, and you can leave them all out there all day because they are content and they are at peace because they are reconnecting with their mother. And so that's what the drum represents to us. They say it's the heartbeat of the earth, but really it represents our mother, our physical mother, and our earth, the earth, the planet.
Manaz, any drums in Muslim practice generally?
Well, in the very beginning, you know, that was a way of communication. You know, when there was battles, there was how, you know, when they would go forward or backwards, that kind of thing with the drums. And now I think more so it's cultural. You know, different parts of the world use drums in their own cultural ways. Mm-hmm. It's not so much in the religious as today.
And I read, Rinpoche, that in Tibetan Buddhism there is an entire sort of spiritual practice that involves a person being alone with a drum. Is that something you're familiar
yeah.
with?
Yeah. The drums, you know, in Tibetan tradition, there's you know several different types of the drums, and some are quite big and some are quite small. And the drums play a very important role for example, invoking spiritual experience, and also drums also we use for offerings. And there's a specific drums that we use for, particularly for really inner deep experience of a kind of really advanced spiritual experience, which integrated with the drum. That drum is kind of specific drum, a little bit smaller. So, yes, drums, you know, then in a drum, as a, you know, general in the cultures in the world, you know, drum was used for variety of reasons. Some becomes like a part of the culture. You know, so I think the individual's intention when they use the drum is that you can use the drum as a, like a very deepening and spiritual experience. And, you know, you can use the drum as a, just as a signal, and drum as just a kind of cultural symbolic. So I think it plays, even modern days, from ancient to even today's, you know, drums plays very, very, you know, not only spiritual environment, drums plays a very important role, you know, some of the roles into the part of the community, some celebrations or some kind of, to, how you say, the drums, I think, the sound of the drums have an effect into our human conscious to some way to simplify and to become kind of creating the base to some kind of let going and being into a state of awareness, some kind of stillness. So it was used for many different purposes.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Your experience of objects, sights, and sounds in your religious practice, give us a call. Eva in Kansas City, welcome to Up to Date.
Hello. One of the things that I wanted to do is I wanted to add to what Janet had previously said.
Uh-huh.
Because she was talking about, you know, the bells and the incense and the things like that in the Catholic Church. And I kind of hearken that to the ritual of, like, bedtime for putting your child to sleep. You're altering their mental state so that they are more equipped to do what is needed to be done. So when you are essentially having the incense and the drums and the various bells or music or whatever the case may be that's in your particular religious practices, those are altering your state so that you can be more in tune with your divine or your creator. And I've been listening a lot to what Moses has said, and I kind of heard him touch upon that too. So I just thought that that was, you know, something that it does have a sensory effect, even though it's a physical type of stimulus.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Eva. Thanks for bringing that up.
Right, thank you.
You know, Eva mentions the again, sort of the way that objects bring us to a certain place. They're an instrument for getting us to the spiritual. And we've also talked about the symbolic value of many of these objects during this hour. I wonder, is there another aspect of these objects that we haven't talked as much about, namely that they in and of themselves have a certain sacredness or specialness, that they themselves bear significance? Is that part of any objects or sensory experiences in your traditions, Manaz?
Well, for me, I wear a couple rings on my hand, and when I look at them, it reminds me of how I practice my faith. So yes, I do that. I also like to wear a pendant that has a picture of the Kaaba and Medina, where the Prophet is buried. And so for me, these are just things that I like to wear, just to keep me present to my faith.
They're reminders to yourself.
To myself. And then also I wear a headscarf, and so when I'm out in public, that also, you know, when I put that on, it's telling that, you know, I am going out as a Muslim woman. So these are things that I do as a practicing Muslim.
I'm thinking of, we mentioned bread earlier, in the Catholic tradition there is a belief that in the Mass, that at a certain point bread actually changes substance to be the body of Christ. Are there similar examples of places where objects take on, you know, actual spiritual, where the spiritual and the physical come together within these objects in any of your traditions?
Well, for me, just like what she was talking about, I braid my hair.
Mm-hmm.
Every morning I braid my hair, and one strand represents Wakuntaka, the creator of all creation. Another strand represents the earth, which is also my physical being. and the third strand represents my spirit. As a reminder of how I must walk in this day, all three are brought together as one, and which we have the capability to do so as common people, you know, but we've allowed ourselves to doubt ourselves so much that we deny our well-being, our who we are, and the strengths that we truly have to walk as spiritual beings in a physical concept or a physical understanding. So me braiding my hair every day is my constant reminder that I do have. No one can tell me that, oh, you can't do that. Yes, I can. You know, because my creator is that powerful of all of ours, because it's the same creator. It's the same God.
Rinpoche, did I hear you trying to jump in there?
Yes, sorry. So from the Buddhist point of view, no object by nature is kind of spiritual or neither. You know, it's just object. And the person who's relating with the object, the person have a deeper experience. And when the persons have an inner transformation, then they can transform the object, by its own virtue, by its own side, nothing becomes a holy. Nothing becomes a secret. So it all depends to the participant, the person, the practitioner. When their person's, their mind and their awareness becomes holy and spiritual, and any object can become spiritual and holy. So, but now again, so therefore, one key thing is also in some of the practice, meditation practice and a training into a concentration training, objects becomes a hindrance because senses becomes a distractions. So therefore, sometimes those objects doesn't become. It all kind of depends to the situations, you know, journey of their, you know, experience. You know, sometimes they become a supporting condition. Sometimes they become a hindrance, and sometimes they become holy not by his own object, by the. No, practitioners, when they becomes mind becomes holy, then object becomes.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that an object might be a hindrance. I guess I wonder if all of our guests could reflect a little bit on the ways that objects, in fact, have been a source of maybe conflict among religions or among even within religions, practitioners of the same religion. I'm thinking about land that more than one group regards as holy, the placement of a rock, the placement of holy places. We think about the city of Jerusalem, where several religions claim similar sites as holy, and that has sometimes been a source of conflict. What do we make of that? Is that to be expected? Is that something that that religious practice has an answer for? Manoz?
I think it's because we're human beings and we're fallible. We make mistakes. But one of my dear friend of mine, she was telling me about, if you want to take a picture of Jerusalem, you cannot take a picture of just your own faith. You have to take a picture that has all three. And I think that is something that was supposed to happen. You know, it was just supposed to be there. So again, it's to remind us that we have to live. There's an ayah in the Quran that says, I made you into many nations and tribes so you may know one another. So from a Muslim perspective, you know, God has asked us that I didn't want you all to be the same. I wanted you to be different. And so, so I see that could be a conflict, but I think it's also is meant to happen.
Yeah, and Moses, you mentioned earlier the way you've seen objects used outside of the tradition tends to get under your skin.
Well, it does. It's such a huge distraction, you know, because people don't. There's a spiritual connection. There is a respect that so many people deny or don't give. I mean, you know, it's okay. Yeah, I got an eagle feather, and people maybe that individual didn't earn it, you know. But they paid for it. Mm-hmm. Or I got a drum. They didn't earn that drum, but they paid for it. And so they're destructive to individuals who are truly walking that path, which are far and few in between today, that are making those steps to earn things. And it doesn't have nothing to do with nationality. It has everything to do with our lifestyle. Everything is sacred. If we as common people can honestly look at the world and the earth and honestly see the sacredness of it, then maybe we would treat it much better and we respect it for generations yet to come. Because today, I don't think we even care about generations to come. Because if it were so, then we would stop poisoning the earth. and get back to the basis of our true religious ways, our spiritual ways, which is about love. We should love one another and view each other as brothers and sisters. We should start seeing each other as being sacred.
The whole thing about the seven generations, right?
Right, exactly. You know, we are going to be held accountable for that. As you say, the judgment day. And I believe that what my physical body can experience here, I can also experience spiritually.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Not unfortunately. I think that's a very good place for us to leave it. I want to thank our guests today, Manaz Shabir. She's president of Shabir Advisors and active in the local Muslim community. Moses Brings Plenty works with the Heart of America Indian Center as community outreach liaison and arts and culture coordinator. And Yangsi Rinpoche is president of Maitripa College in Portland and a Buddhist spiritual director as well. Thanks to all of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You can find more information about them and about all our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and go to the KCUR page. You can also follow this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.